Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
For over 23 years, David Akeman was a senior correspondent and foreign correspondent with Time magazine. He reported from five continents, more than 55 countries, and interviewed some major world figures, Mother Teresa, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Boris Yeltsin, and Billy Graham included. He's a professor of history. He's the author of 13 books, including the well-known Jesus in Beijing, and he speaks six languages. David Akeman, welcome to Australia again. It's good to have you on Open House.
Thank you for having me on the program.
And you know, I'm not intimidated by that CV at all.
Well, I hope not, because nobody else is.
It's only about a quarter of what you've done. It's been quite an amazing few years that you've actually had.
Well, it's been there have been a lot of wonderful opportunities.
Both opportunities to cover some of the biggest stories in history,
right,
in recent history.
Exactly.
And to talk to some of the most amazing people in history, too.
Yeah.
I'm interested that I've mentioned a few people there, Mother Teresa, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Boris Yeltsin, Billy Graham. That's just the beginning. Who's left the most impact on you after chatting with them?
That's a good question. I think Solzhenitsyn was the person who made the biggest impression upon me, both for the extraordinary power of his intellect and for the moral force that he brought into the discussions. I mean, you realized here is a man whose ideas were forged in the most unbelievably stressful circumstances, and yet he wasn't bitter. He was extraordinarily measured, and he actually was quite humorous. I had expected a rather dour sort of Old Testament prophetic figure, because he has a beard and so on. But he was very amusing, very polite, and just fascinating to talk to.
The Gulag Archipelago, his famous book, still continues to be one of the most disturbing books I've ever read. Obviously, chronicling his experiences in the Soviet Russia's concentration camps. And a good deal of it, of course, I couldn't relate to with some of the geographical locations, but boy, the horror of what he and so many others on the concentration camp actually experienced there.
Yeah.
And so you found he had a sense of humor, and yet he was able to... I mean, his book actually was a pivotal turning point in actually the stories getting out about the horror, wasn't it?
Right. Well, that's true. The Gulag Archipelago came out in 1973. He'd written First Circle and Cancer Ward, his two novels, and he made his debut with One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, which was a sort of prelude to the Gulag, and in dramatic form, I think, had more impact upon waking up Russians to what had happened in the Soviet Union than the Gulag, which took longer to sort of filter back into the Soviet Union.
Billy Graham, I'm working hard with the Billy Graham Evangelist Association to try and get a bit of time with Billy. I would love to speak with Billy Graham. How did you find Billy?
Well, I last had a full interview with Billy, more than 10 years ago. I did meet with him just before the beginning of the new millennium to discuss a project. Billy, I think, gave his most interesting interviews probably in the 1990s. What he's said recently has either been a sort of recycling of what he's said on previous occasions, or revealed that he was really pretty tired and perhaps not as much on top of things as he once was. But I think the most amazing thing about Billy Graham was the degree to which he could laugh at himself. At the last time I met him, he said, you know, people want to put me on a pedestal and want to make a saint out of me, but he said, I'm deeply flawed like everybody else. I'm a sinner. And you knew he wasn't just saying that. He had no audience except a few people. And I think he has had a tremendously healthy dislike of the adulation in which he's been held, and his dear wife, the late Ruth Graham, had a wonderful way of pulling him down when he was beginning to believe his own press releases. I think it was an amazing combination.
How'd you do that, though?
Well, I'll give you an example. He was once talking about having met with Fidel Castro and embraced Castro or something, and Ruth Graham quickly chimed in, Billy, he embraces everybody he meets.
You're not the only one.
And also a story that is quite publicized, when he was slightly tempted by a large offer of money to run for the presidency of the United States in 1964, the year, of course, when Lyndon Johnson hammered Barry Goldwater very decisively. The Republicans, some Republicans, were trying to get him to run. And Ruth Graham sent him a message saying, don't run for president, because if you do, you'll be the first divorced person to run for president, because I'll divorce you if you do. You know?
Interesting that you mentioned there about the fact that he was offered to run for the presidency. Looking back now, we'd actually see that as a distraction on what his primary
Absolutely.
Calling from God was.
Totally.
And he also talks about in his biographies about for a little while there he was the president of a Christian college, which in hindsight he also said was basically a distraction from what he had actually been called to do.
Yes, that's right. His at the very outset of his career, he was the president of Northwestern schools in outside Minneapolis, and he wasn't a very good college administrator, and he didn't like the job. And Ruth, interestingly enough, had never been consulted in the decision to take that job. And that was another instance where I think also he'd taken a job as pastor of a Baptist church after getting out of Wheaton College in 1943. Ruth was not informed about it, and he took the job, and clearly he was not cut out to be a pastor. He was quickly distracted from that and returned to his proper position as an evangelist.
Great lessons for those of us wanting to find our calling and actually stick to it.
Right.
Mother Teresa.
She was the sort of woman, and many people said this after meeting her, who, when she talked to you, made you feel as though God was looking into your soul. It wasn't a sense of being x-rayed by a sort of divine morality machine. I mean, you didn't get the sense that she was about to pounce on some folly that you may have committed. But she seemed to be so transparent to God in her own life, at least that's the impression one got, that when she talked to you, she really focused upon you, and you sensed that, in a way, God was speaking to you through her. It was an amazing experience.
Mm. Of course, she actually came to the world's acknowledgement, really, through Malcolm Muggeridge.
That's right, yes. Muggeridge put her on the map.
Did you have any contact with him?
No, I never met Muggeridge. Muggeridge, of course, has been heavily criticized by the atheist Christopher Hitchens, who wrote a horrible book called The Missionary Position, essentially digging up every single malevolent story about Mother Teresa that had been narrated by disgruntled former colleagues. And Hitchens claimed that she was sort of, she was a phony and this, that, and the other. So she was not very wise in the ways of the world. I mean, when she first visited South Africa, she apparently had not known that there was such a system as apartheid in South Africa, which indicates a sort of astonishing lack of preparation for that. But everything, any mistake she may have made, was so completely eclipsed in my mind by the phenomenal achievement of these homes for the dying, for the lepers, and for orphans all over the world in what, something like 110 countries, that I think it's really carping in the most unpleasant way to criticize us in that way.
Yes. Veteran journalist David Akeman is with us. You've also covered some pretty amazing historical events, fall of the Berlin Wall, Tiananmen Square, etc. What would be the biggest event for you, again, in terms of your own personal impact you've covered?
I would say, obviously, at the top of the list would have to be the suppression of the student activists in Tiananmen Square. I mean, the degree of violence was just unbelievable. And I remember being close to the square at about 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning on June the 4th, which was the morning of the massacre. And I remember counting 8 different places in Beijing around the city where tracers were being fired into the air. People thought, well, you know, the army came in and suppressed the students in the square, which they did. But getting to the square from the south of the city, from the east of the city, from the west of the city, involved shooting people to get there. Hmm. And I don't think we'll ever know exactly how many people died, but I suspect it was in the thousands.
Mm. What aspect of Tiananmen Square wasn't reported, apart from your own diligent reporting yourself? What do you think did we not hear about?
I think we heard basically the whole story. I don't think people realize the extent to which the whole of the city of Beijing had basically shucked off communist control. There was a period between Sunday, June the 4th, 1989, and Thursday, the following week, by which time the buses started running again. There was a period of about 4 or 5 days, and I remember I got on a bicycle and I rode around the city, when the only part of the city that was in the control of the government was the square itself, which was ringed by tanks. Everywhere else, you could not see a single person in uniform. I mean, basically, Beijing had become a non-communist city during that time.
Wow.
And people came up to you on the street and thanked you for being there to report. One old man grabbed me by the lapels and said, "Thank you for telling the world what the Chinese government is doing to the Chinese people."
Mm-hmm. Wow. Do you have a view on the current situation with Beijing and the Olympics coming up, and whether sporting stars should actually make some sort of stand and boycott or anything like that?
I don't think there should be any kind of boycott. I think it what's happened in Tibet is unfortunate, but boycotts in the Olympic have a notoriously unsuccessful history to them. And besides which, I think at the present time, with the enormous sympathy for the victims of the earthquake, Beijing is becoming, or China's becoming, much less nationalistic. They suddenly realize that the rest of the world isn't ganging up to try to humiliate them, which is what they were getting the impression of earlier. And I think we're going into the Olympics with a much more benign view of the world, but on the part of China, and of China on the part of the world.
Right. Well, speaking of China, one of your probably most successful books has actually been Jesus in Beijing.
Right.
Where you've chronicled the massive explosion of Christianity in China.
Right.
It's a well-known story now. What most surprised you when you really started getting into the story and finding out the causes, trends, etc.? What most surprised you about the situation there?
I think what most surprised me was the extraordinary degree of commitment of Christians who had to do everything in almost complete secrecy. The secret seminaries that I found on the hillside and in apartments in the city, the degree of secrecy of a Christian music academy in Beijing, which was being directed by one of China's greatest conductors. The skill, the effort, the care that went to making sure that the Christian effort, the Christian activities of these groups was not compromised. That was just amazing. I have since updated the book and gone back to China. I was back in China in February, in January this year. And what struck me then was how much the Chinese intelligentsia, the professionals, have been infected by Christianity. The Chinese intellectuals and professionals are coming to Christianity in absolutely unprecedented numbers.
Why? What is the attraction for them?
The basic attraction is the spiritual and intellectual and philosophical vacuum at the center of Chinese life today. Chinese are obviously much better off than they were under Mao Zedong. They have considerably more freedoms. They can travel, they can make money, they can choose their own lifestyle in all kinds of ways that would have been unimaginable earlier. But there's great prosperity, but also great corruption. There's bribery. And China no longer believes in communism. I mean, I guess there must be five people in the country who still believe in Marxism, Leninism, Mao thought. So what do you believe in? Getting rich is an admirable practical instruction for people who have been suppressed in their initiative earlier. But does it make you feel fulfilled? Does it make you feel that your country has a vital purpose in the world? And Chinese intellectuals are finding that Christianity is the best way to make sense both of Chinese culture, Chinese tradition, and the state of the world as they see it.
That is really quite fascinating. To what degree, then, are these folks in the intelligentsia, in the academia circles, and then maybe even indeed in circles of power further up, to what degree are they able to freely express this faith? Well, it's all secret?
No, let me tell you. I met a Communist Party, fairly senior official, a teacher in the Communist Party school, who at that time, he's now a Christian, but 5 months ago he wasn't, but he was very sympathetic to Christianity purely because he saw that Christianity was good, that wherever there were many Christians in the Chinese countryside, there was less crime, less corruption, harder work and so forth. And he has now decided that he wants to get my book, Jesus in Beijing, translated and published in China legally. This was a book that was essentially banned 4 years ago, but he wants every single Chinese leader to read it because he believes that Christianity is the secret to China's future greatness.
So in what kind of time frame could we see quite a mass turning? We're already seeing a mass turning in terms of numbers, but even at this level there where the persecution actually begins to drop off, etc.
Well, I think there will still be a degree of persecution because China is such a large and varied country. I mean, we think of it as centralized under Communist Party control, sending out, you know, edicts and instructions from Beijing, but actually it's a series of provincial power bases, some of whose leaders are relatively unsympathetic to Christianity, and others of whose leaders want Christianity to flourish. So you've got a great variety in the local conditions for Christianity. But I have projected in my book that by, well, maybe 2030, about 25% of China may be Christian. And by that measure, China will be a Christianized nation. If you get 25 to 30%, then you have a Christian influence throughout society, in media, government, the military, the judiciary. I think China will be the next global Christian superpower.
And on that, I wish we had another 3 hours to explore that. David Aikman, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, very interesting. DavidAikman.com for more, but a former Time journalist, author, educator, consultant to many, guest speaker at this year's Christians in the Media Conference. And I must thank Dominic Steele from the CIM Group for arranging that visit with David.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.